the work of liberation in the Buddhist tradition is very often described in kind of two almost sort of archetypally different ways that in a sense create a spectrum of kinds of practice. And one way we can think of this spectrum is that one end of the spectrum, one pole of practice or of realization of the path to liberation is oriented around suffering in relation to what we can let go of or renounce or set aside in our lives, such that that setting aside would relieve a tension or contraction or suffering that we were experiencing before. So like we notice that grasping at things that are inherently unstable is painful. And so then this end of the spectrum, which is the renunciate end or the letting go end of the spectrum, says, well, if we can let go of needing things to be a certain way or let go of gaining or having that thing, then we won't suffer because it's going to change anyway. If we didn't grasp, we don't suffer. That's the renunciate end of the spectrum. But this is a spectrum that really talks about how or how much we engage with the changing experience of our lives. And so the other end of the spectrum we could call engagement. And we engage with things in order to change their course in a certain way. And so I think of if the renunciate end of the spectrum is the letting go, letting things be as they are, the engagement end of the spectrum is to lean in to take an active or volitional role in shifting things. And so I call this healing, since the most sincere, in a way, intention is to heal, or if we say it more bluntly, fix an experience. So like, you know, I'm not making enough money to feel super, super comfortable. I think that it's within my power to change that. And so I lean in the direction of like, well, let's work on that. Let's get some skills or somehow figure out how to change that. That's a different way to engage than to say, well, this is how much I make, and it's better if I just learn to be comfortable at this level of things, whether or not I have the power to change them or not, right? And it's different if you have that power or don't. But the gesture of letting go and saying, I accept things as they are, both, in a sense, are oriented toward relieving suffering, right? Do I relieve the suffering of a given situation by learning to accept it as it is without complaint? Or do I lessen the suffering in a situation by leaning in to change it towards something that's better? And there's these two ways. And of course, the vast majority of what we do is somewhere in the middle, yeah? Like, there's a shadow on both ends, right? The shadow of wholesome renunciation is like disengagement or disinterest, nihilism, right? There could be, or the shadow would be, like a disempowered position. Oh, I feel like I can't change things, or I've given up in a certain way, right? That's not wholesome in the way that letting go through wisdom is, but they're close, right? That would be what's called like the near enemy. On the engagement side, right, there's engagement that's healing, right, to shift a given situation toward more well-being for myself or others or both. Very close to that is grasping at comfort, right, trying, needing to make it things better. And again, it's the shadow because ultimately we only have so much agency. Right? Conditions keep changing all around us. Greed, hatred, and delusion seem endless. So we can fix a little bit, and then, you know, more trash comes down the river. You clean it up, more comes down. You clean it up, more comes down. So how much do you clean up the river as it flows by, and how much do you step back and be like, rivers have trash, and you rest. as it goes by. So in a certain kind of cartoonish way, the earliest layer of the tradition is associated more with the renunciate direction, right? Become a monastic, let go of possessions, let go of using money, let go of using sexuality, let go of activity in the larger world in a certain way, in order to focus on the deep liberation that comes when you let go of everything, even a preference for life over death. Right? You understand that birth and death is a flowing process. And the grasping for anything to be different than it is can fall away. And that's considered liberation. That's probably the earliest layer of the Buddhist system evolving. But very quickly, really within a few hundred years after the life of the Buddha, there emerged this new movement that we've been talking about called the Mahayana, the great vehicle. Maha, great, yana, vehicle. And this vehicle leaned away from the renunciate side of practice toward the engagement side. And we've been talking about the way that it leaned toward engagement, this almost absurd, vast wish that you would give rise to or cause to happen in yourself, the wish to be able to save everybody everywhere. Right? There's sentient beings or conscious beings are numberless. I vow to save them all. It's one of the great Zen vows. Or as it's expressed in the Diamond Sutra, the Bodhisattva is one who saves all beings. Right? In the realm of complete nirvana, I shall liberate them all, countless beings. And the text goes through, we talked about last week, this list of like wherever they come from, however they're born, beings of any kind, in any place, in whatever conceivable realm of being one might conceive of beings. In the realm of complete nirvana, I shall liberate them all. This implies a kind of outward-looking orientation that's different from the inward renunciation of the earliest layer. It says, like, no, other beings, all those beings, I will save them. And so then this archetype, this is the Bodhisattva archetype, this and the sort of the heart of the Mahayana, this has been beautifully connected with in the modern period as a support for social action in a certain way, as a almost like a religious or doctrinal suggestion that one of the most beautiful pathways to deep liberation is to orient toward the well-being of others. I will save them all sentient beings. And so then we have, in a way, a beautiful partnership of archetypes. We have the archetype of the one who lets go deeply into just being, and perhaps even lets go of being itself as a category. I'll leave that one aside for now. Whatever that means, to let go that fully, there's that direction. That's that choice that one makes. Or there's a choice to engage with or to stay present with others as they suffer, and then attempt this absurd, beautiful task of universal uplift. I will save them all. It's important that there's the all in there, not just like, I will save a bunch of them, you know? Because to save a bunch of them would make it into a kind of a competition. Like, you know, it's like, well, I got 15 people, you know? And it's like, well, I'm working on my 17th, so, you know, I'm ahead of you. Like, if it's an amount, it becomes doable. If it's infinite, it becomes something else. And it's the infinite that the vow goes toward. This might not sound like a beginner's talk at this moment. But hang in there. Basically, two things to do. Let go or lean in. And then a huge spectrum of activity between the two. And of course, most of what we do is some combination of those things, right? I lean into my relationship, but I try not to take certain things personally. Yeah, I try to let go when it's right to let go, and engage when it's right to engage. And of course, learning to do that is the game of incarnation, of being here. Is how do you do that? What's right? What's wholesome would be the word, kusala in Pali, the word meaning skillful or wholesome. What's wholesome to do in this moment? One of the ways this played out historically was was as a metaphor or image. So I'm going to give you this really ancient image. This is probably one of the earliest teaching tools in the Buddhist system. And it's an image of a wheel. And the wheel has on it depictions of six ways of being that we see conscious beings in. This is the picture of the six realms. It's part of what's called the wheel of life, the wheel of birth and death. The whole wheel is being held in the jaws of Yama, who is death. So, just in case you forgot that part, every form of existence is subject to birth and death. But then within that, there's this depiction of the range of experience from incredibly pleasurable to incredibly painful. And the six realms are these, briefly. From most pleasurable to least pleasurable. There are realms called divine or godly, where beings are healthy, happy, long-lived, feeling safe, deeply cared for, such that they could orient toward pleasure or really anything they want for a very long time. And so you can get the flavor. It's a state, right? You might have been in this state yourself as part of your human life in a moment when you were extremely comfortable or well taken care of or blessed. Or you might know people that live kind of in that state, right? Every realm has its wonderful qualities and its terrible qualities. The wonderful quality of the God realm is that deep peace and happiness of it. Its terrible quality, of course, is that there's delusion in it. It can be a deluded, kind of blinded realm. Mm-hmm. The gods don't notice suffering because they don't have any, mm-hmm. much. The tiny bit that they have is that they don't really know. They're not wise, so they don't really understand that they got to the position they're in because of their own good actions in the past, and that karma or that effect is finite, like it runs out. Your momentum runs out. Death shows up. And when death happens, then that, whether that's a metaphorical death, like that part of your life is over, tragedy strikes, or physical death actually just ends the pleasurable life, that it just can't be sustained. And so loss is embedded in the divine life. And the gods are said to live these tremendously long, beautiful lives, but die in the end. And when they die, that karmic force that was propelling them to be there kind of dissolves into the universe and reappears elsewhere in a more suffering state, right? If they started to suffer, oh my gosh, I'm dying. I'm losing this incredible pleasure. That state itself is the fall from grace. And then something else is happening. The state next below the God realm in terms of painfulness is a state also characterized by lots of pleasure and ease, but it has the qualities of jealousy and power hunger. So this is like folks that have a lot of privilege and power, but their mind state or the state of their heart is consumed by competition and grasping and trying to be better than they want the state of the gods, but they're not quite there. They're suffering with the contraction, and so this is a violent kind of warring realm, but it's comfortable and wealthy and you know, privileged, we would say in modern language as well. These are the asuras, the titans or demigods, to use mythical language. And then the next more painful realm than that is called the human realm, as a realm that has a mixture of all of them, I would say, but really a mixture of pleasure and pain in a way that we are better at being self-aware than any of the other realms. That's our thing as humans. That's the human thing, is self-awareness. It's the thing that differentiates us from the other realms. So that's the main thing that we have going for us, is that we can do awareness practice in a way that even the gods can't really do. And we can do it because we have this mix of pleasure and pain, and it keeps us awake in a certain way. Not too comfortable, not too tormented. The next realm, the next more difficult realm, is the animal realm. And it's characterized by dullness and repetition and the kind of predator-prey situation, a kind of constancy of habitual role and less self-consciousness. So there's often not even so much a consciousness that they're suffering other than the deep physiological kind of sufferings of, you know, fear of being eaten and the constancy of animal life. This begins, the animal life begins the what are called the lower or more difficult realms, and they're difficult not just because they have a lot of pain in them, but because they're difficult to get out of. In the same way that like a really contracted mind state is hard to just jump out of. When you notice like, oh, I'm depressed or I'm anxious, you get the sense of the suffering that you're in, but it's not like you can snap out of it just because you notice it. But you have to notice it to start off. And then you have to be able to do things, take actions that'll shift your state. And so like in the mythical layer, like the actions that animals take to gain a better rebirth is the sort of literalist way to think about it. There are all these moments where they have an opportunity to express a quality that's a little more human, like generosity or empathy or care for another. So there's all these stories of like, you know, an animal who offers their body to feed, you know, another starving animal, like to take care of the other animal, right? And that moment of offering themselves generously is enough of a mind state to kick their karma out of that endless repetition and into another state, you know, and it'll, you know, bump them up to the human realm. This is a video game model. The next realm down is called the hungry ghost realm, and it's a realm characterized by intense, unrelievable wanting and hunger, and the hungry ghosts are these kind of sort of spirit beings, but you can just also think of them as tremendously tormented living beings. We've seen some, hopefully not many, live. But their image is of like a being with a huge distended belly, like the starving, about to die, starving kind of distended belly and tiny mouths. And they can never get enough to eat or drink. And it's just this like this visceral not enoughness is the hungry ghost realm. And they haunt these kind of barren landscapes, just searching for sustenance and never finding enough. And then the most painful of the realms are the hell realms that are described in a way that many cultures do very traditionally as places of horrendous torment. Fiery hells, cold hells, hells of very imaginatively described ways to be killed over and over painfully and then immediately revived so that you have to go through the pain again and again. Like realms, you know, described as if they are the most painful thing ever that a body could endure or not be able to endure but then be forced to endure for very long periods of time. So this model, these six realms that range from extremely painful to extremely pleasant, but are all held within death, constant change, loss, etc. The idea of liberation is based in the sense that these are the realms where consciousness, conscious life happens. And you can take them as literal, sort of mythical places. That's probably certainly in different cultures, various times and places, they've been taken very literally. But you can also, and this is also in the early texts, you can read them psychologically or metaphorically. And, you know, you can take a walk from one part of the city to another and encounter all six of these types of beings. You know, people in tremendous torment, people whose want or need is so deep it can't be satisfied. People, I'm just going to call them all people. The technical word would be sentient beings, but you know, people, beings whose lives are embedded in a kind of dull, painful, habitual cycle that's very difficult to break out of. People who are somewhere in the middle and are trying to get better, trying to heal, trying to grow. People who have forgotten that and are powerful somehow and are beating down others to try to get more. And then folks who somehow have gotten as much as can be gotten in this world and are oblivious to what's happening around them and are just resting in sort of the subtle states that come when there's so much resource focused in one place. You can see all of these kinds of people around, not to mention the actual animals and actual kind of spirit beings that you can discern when you're sensitive to them. And so then the renunciate model on this spectrum, renunciate, engage, let go, lean in, heal. The renunciate side recognizes that no matter what part of that you're partaking in, whether the extremely wealthy or the extremely poor, the extremely privileged, the extremely oppressed, that they all have their own, we could now say, trauma, but that they all have their own limitation. None of them is the answer. Climbing the American dream ladder and getting into the God realm, it's possible, but it's not actually an answer to what you want. Right? Once you can see that realm just, it has its own kind of suffering. The desire, the hunger to attain it softens or weakens or even drops away entirely at times or forever. Once you see that every kind of existence is possible and that sentient beings, conscious beings, living beings have these kinds of lives, these horrifyingly painful lives, these tremendously deluded lives, these lives of that maybe you most identify with the human realm and you're like, I'm just a sincere seeker trying to find my way in a complex world. That's the human condition. So welcome to the human birth. Among the six, that's where you probably are. But you almost certainly have had moments of really getting a taste of what the others feel like. Yeah? There's drugs that you can take that'll put you in any of them, right? There's parties that you can go to that try to put you in some of them and may succeed or may fail wildly. And the circumstances of this world of just weather and war and changing governments and like nothing is certain, right? This could be a burning, bombed out war zone in any moment. And we could be in a hell realm of loss and fear and hatred, in a more literal way. And people all around are in those states anyway. Yeah? So once you get this, the renunciate option is to let go of the whole thing. And that's the gesture, is to take a step back from wanting to be in any of them. And then this amazing thing happens where the impulse to get better quiets in a certain way. And what emerges is a kind of incredible serenity of heart. Wherever you are, this is why people wake up to profound freedom in all sorts of places. Right? They wake up in the middle of prison terms on death row, and they wake up in the middle of war zones, and they wake up in the middle of ordinary life with kids running everywhere around. It happens. People let go of clinging, and it just opens up. That's the renunciate side. And the extreme end of that is really the choice in one's life to set aside engagement more fully and to give the remainder of your life to contemplation, to stillness. This is really what I'll call the monastic option. And I complain often that we don't have a strong one in this country. It's not easy to do. There's not a lot of places to go. But they do exist, and you can go. Join that option fully. But what starts to emerge in this Mahayana, the great vehicle, is a way of thinking about these six realms that doesn't just rely on letting go of it fully to be liberation. An image that starts to appear is that in every one of these realms, there are pictures on this wheel of life. In every one of these realms is a little picture of a Buddha, a little tiny standing, mostly, figure, teaching, or showing up to help. And the idea being that, like, in any realm, there still is, can be contact with that which will uplift, that which will save you. And Buddhas show up in every realm. But, of course, who is that Buddha? And the teaching is like, well, that's you, of course. You make the vow to show up in every realm. That's the Bodhisattva vow, right? All beings in all realms, in all places, I will save them all. You know, all that means is like, oh, I'm willing to show up in your realm and engage with what is happening here and serve this realm. And so this is a profoundly powerful but different vision of what spiritual life is than the full letting go option. Okay? It says, well, you enter, you engage. And but, engage doesn't mean become one with. The Buddha doesn't cease to be a Buddha and lose the robes, lose the halo, lose the radiant purity and become a hell being, become a hungry ghost, become an animal, become a confused human, become a jealous god or a god. The Buddha always stays a Buddha. The Bodhisattva always is a Bodhisattva in any realm. And so how do you get to be that clear? Well, you do a whole bunch of letting go first, right? You can't actually do bodhisattva practice if you are a hungry ghost or a hell realm person or a human or a god. You have to a little bit abstract yourself from those identities in order to be the one who kind of has even something to say, to teach, to be in your example in those realms. So they're actually, they're poles of a spectrum, but they're always interwoven. Right? Even if you decide to be a monastic and let go completely, you have to engage quite a bit with the world to find your way there. And then, of course, you're still in the world. So people keep showing up and wanting to engage with you. You know, you're like, go away, I'm on retreat. But, like, actually, you do a bunch of years of retreat and the impulse shifts. And you're ready to chat with people. And it almost always happens. Right? There's a few full-time hermits in the world, and God bless them. Don't come out. But, you know, it's messy out here. But almost everyone who takes that path becomes a teacher at some point, becomes one of those robed figures in the hell realms in some way. So the two options are actually just, they're poles of a spectrum. They're sort of aspects of ourself in a way. It's not like you choose one or choose the other. Our practice then becomes this beautiful, and this is, it's just sort of fractals down into everything we do, including even like in a given sitting period. Do I engage with this thought? Like, oh, I'm really thinking this thing about my psychology, about my, I'm having an insight about my mother. She's like this, I'm like this, oh my God. Do I engage with that and lean into it and be like, you know, essentially be like, may this understanding deepen and fully flower in me, and I engage with the content? Heal that part, really know it in my bones? Or do I watch it arise, and my practice right now is to stand back from everything arising, pleasant or unpleasant, and I let it sort of bloom in my awareness and then pass through like the fragrance of jasmine. Can't be held onto. And I just continue to let it flow through. So our practice always, in a way, weaves between these two aspects of what we do in response to the unfolding material of awareness within awareness. So, to open into some discussion, a question to think about, to reflect on. When I feel, this is sort of like a question to ask yourself or to feel into. When I feel or open myself to the complexity of the world, to what's going on right now, in whatever way, that could be the complexity of my family, you know, or all the way out to whatever level of news I take in, however big my circle is, when I open myself up to the complexity of the world, what's my natural impulse? And I'll say, like, at this point in my life, because I think they change at different times in our life. But, like, where I am right now, what's my impulse? And in a very basic way, sensing whether it's a kind of pulling back from it or a kind of digging in. Just ask yourself the question if it's interesting to you. And I sense the complexity of the world. What's my impulse in relation to it at this moment in my life? You might get one or the other or a mixture, almost certainly a mixture. Hang out with that for a moment. See if you can sense or really feel the impulse. A little pulling back or a little leaning in or something else. And a second question. Can I tell, or how would I tell, if this is habitual? How would I be able to know whether this is, how learned this is? Or a different way to say that would be, is this what I really want? Is this how I want to be in relation to things? Let's hear from a few folks, if anyone who is willing to speak to either one or both of those. What do you find as you feel into this sort of like foundation layer of where our actions come from? What did you find for either of those questions? Maybe we'll hear from a few folks just to get a sense of what it's like. Yeah, Lisa.
It feels like both. Leaning in and pulling back. And the habitual seems more like leaning in. And when I think of it being both, it feels like the more renunciate feels kind of more like roots, and the engagement feels like the plant that's seen, and so there's more stability, and there's both. And the inclination to want to pull back, I think, is to just give it really grounded roots and stability, but there's always seems to be a just a pulling toward action.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I have a
please.
Similar, I just had the same image of being on a tightrope. I'm leaning this way all day and many times a day.
Right.
I just want to get over here, leave the world behind, and other times I'm pulling all the way in and I'm balancing, constantly balancing on this razor's edge metaphor or tightrope.
Yeah.
And it's really happening sort of moment to moment.
Yeah.
I can feel it. I can't bear this, back and forth.
Totally. Do you feel like as you try to, in this image of like you're balancing between them, it's almost like I'm pulled in one direction and pulled in the other, I fall in one direction and fall in the other direction. Do you have a sense of what, is the ideal for you to be more balanced at the center? Or, is this a moment in your life where balance for you would mean kind of a preponderance of one over the other, but in a steady way?
It just hit me that all. It's more like, what's my attitude? Am I frightened by this, or am I seeing it as, oh, this is a fun adventure, whatever that guy was, Louis Petit between the World Trade Center.
Oh my God! Makes my legs go to jelly just thinking about it.
Is it fun?
Is it fun?
That's sort of my or am I getting this like terror, just total terror?
Yeah.
I'm gonna fall. Oh, whoa! This is really fun. So sort of forgot. I'm even not thinking of the direction.
Yeah, you can't at a certain point, right? Yeah.
It's like the second you think with a desire, it's bam, one way or the other.
Yeah.
So that's sort of how I'm dealing with it lately.
Mm-hmm. Totally. Yeah. What are your thoughts here?
I see it very differently. Whether or not it's like renunciate or whether or not it's action, it's like the only instrument I have to work with is this. And so if I don't go inside and work with this, then whatever action I do is not wise action.
Yeah.
And then I feel contracted. So the only litmus test or way I have of assessing is if, like in my body, it feels uncomfortable the way in which I engage with. And I try to keep fine-tuning it. You know, it's an ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't see it as different, because if I don't go inside, then I can't, what I say is not listening to others, or what I do is not, it's not right.
Yeah.
So that's all I have.
Yeah.
And so, so I see it as like the same. But I had a question for you. Mm-hmm. You had said when you described the human realm that it's only because we suffer and you said only because we succeed and we suffer or be, I don't know what mm-hmm. the language you said.
Yeah.
If that is what gives us discrimination. You said that. Something like that. Do you know what you... Expand on that a little bit more?
That piece about the human realm is beautiful. It's poignant and beautiful in a certain way. It's emphasized... The main thing that gets emphasized in many of the texts and teachings on the six realms around the human realm is that the... If there was more pleasure or more pain, if there was like too much pleasure or too much pain,
right.
It's being awakening or being kind of self-aware becomes more difficult. We're more lost in the intensity of things. And that the human realm has this somehow ideal balance, and of course it has a huge range right. within it, but that range somehow is defined by like enough of both things that we don't either get super deluded by pleasure or super kind of disorganized by pain, but that somewhere between the two we have the conditions to become, to make conscious choices and to be aware of our state. So we have something like, you know,
there's a workable balance.
There's
some missing piece in there. It's like just because we have pleasure, I mean, dogs have pleasure and pain too. And so what is it that makes us reflect on what's the purpose of my life? Or what to be intentional or to,
right.
to shift something? What is happening?
Right. It seems like, it's a great question. It seems like it is that very, like, self-conscious, it's sometimes thought of as language-based. There's something that we do in reflecting on pleasure and pain that's different than what the dogs do,
right?
My dog just, when I had a dog, like, he just wants more pleasure and less pain, which I also do, but he expresses it in a much more linear way, right? I worry about it, and I go and read Kant and the Buddha and try to figure it out on a deep level and stare into the mirror and wonder what it's all about. And I think about what pleasure means and what pain means. And, you know, and I get into extremely complex relationships trying to manipulate pleasure and pain. And the dog just wants more of the pleasurable thing, right? So it's that awareness and complexity that makes us
the human thing. I just got the hit. I think there has to be a part of that divinity inherent in humanity or people, or else they wouldn't have that question.
Right. We can totally use that word for it.
Something. There has to be something, or else you wouldn't recognize it and go for it.
Exactly. So recognition is the human thing,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
The dog doesn't recognize
right.
themselves
yeah.
in the way that we recognize ourselves. That's the difference. Right? And so, you know, again, if we think of it metaphorically, you could think like, oh, I was in that sort of animal part of my life where, like, I wasn't self-aware. I was just kind of churning along the program and kind of unconsciously just trying to, you know, get a little more pleasure and avoid pain and just kind of keep it rumbling along. And then at a different point, I was more engaged. I was curious. I started to feel in more complexity my situation and engage with it differently.
I have thought about that.
Please.
To me, the realms are all within each of us all the time.
Yeah.
All five or six of them, whatever.
Yeah.
They're going on in different ways.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'm incredibly greedy or selfish or,
yep.
or I feel like a hungry ghost.
Totally.
You know, or a dog, I'm just going for play. I'm not self-conscious at all. And
woof.
You know, and they're sort of all happening simultaneously. And the more human
yeah.
part of me is the part that can hold them all as sort of the container, holding them all
mm-hmm.
going on at once, all doing their thing. And say,
yep.
oh, there you go. You know, so.
And again, so that's the renunciate side of you with some practice expressing
right.
itself, right? That's the part of you that could be, you know, a Buddha. That just means the awareness quality within the realm of, like, the hungry ghost, like, oh, here I am doing that thing where I just want, you know, and here I am doing that thing where I'm just enraged, and here I am doing that thing where I'm kind of like sleepwalking and dull.
But I'm the little bodhisattva.
You're the little bodhisattva. He's the one noticing
he's
it.
He's there, but he's also, the other thing that hit me was he's loving.
Yeah, no, it's
he's
his
loving
thing.
The ghost. He's loving the ghost. He's just like loving the ghost. I want to free liberate you. I want to
yep.
liberate the
yep.
dog. I want to liberate
yep.
the demigod.
Yep. yep.
You know, he's showing up in all of those and just pouring love into those, you know, that's what I...
You got it. You got it. This is why more than renunciation, you know, and kind of liberation, the quality that gets emphasized in the Mahayana is compassion. Compassion is the sort of pinnacle quality rather than, like, equanimity. Equanimity is on the renunciate side. Like, I just let everything be from a deep place of stillness. Everything is the way it is. That's the renunciate side of kind of wisdom power. The compassion side is everything is the way it is, but I care. I care. I have love. Right? So the bodhisattva radiates love to the hell beings. You know? So, you know, very much that. Very much that. And yeah, this is the sort of psychological interpretation of these, which is not a made-up one. Like, it's traditional. It's not recent, not as recent. So different from, like, you know, oh, literal rebirths. I'll die when I'm whatever old, and I'll be reborn in a hell realm or in God realm or whatever. But there's the sense that, like, oh, I die from this state, and I get reborn in another state, you know. Tennessee, Maine, you know. I die from the state of being relatively happy, you know, talking about Dharma with you wonderful people. And, you know, I go outside and somebody gets mad at me and I get scared or whatever, something. You know, I go home and something has happened and I'm angry or I'm scared or I'm proud or whatever. I've died from this realm and I get reborn in that realm, right? And we could enter a hell realm at any moment. We could enter a heaven realm at any moment. You get the right kind of praise and you're a long-lived god coursing in fields of bliss as long as it lasts. And at some point soon, no matter the strength of the state, it changes. So there's this interpretation that we go through these things in a moment-to-moment way. And so then the bodhisattva figure, you know, can you be that one who knows exactly where you are and cares, but kind of holds your ground, you know, holds your clarity in the hell realm, you know, within the God realm. You hold on to enough renunciation to know who you are. And you love the ones who are suffering, grasping, confused.
Which are all you.
Which is all you, to begin with. That's the punchline of the whole text. We'll get back to this as we go on next week and other weeks. Is that you do all of this by realizing that everybody is just you. Like, that it's not like you were other than them. You know, that would be deluded. That would be a sort of God realm delusion to think, like, I'm the great peaceful one and all those beings out there are suffering. That's not actually being the bodhisattva. That's just being in the God realm. So once you recognize that, you're like, oh, right, that wasn't it. It was actually that everyone and myself are embodying existence in this very moment. And how much clarity can I bring to that? Any other questions or thoughts here?
Thinking about the word, what you said, acceptance, like accepting, yeah. Just accepting the way things are.
Yeah.
Like almost like as if that was like a renunciate side.
Mm-hmm.
But also I could see it as like when you accept things as they are, like if, like for instance, like in a meditation practice, I feel like that's when things do shift. It is like fixing,
right?
Or something.
It's interesting. It's sort of ninja practice, right? Because like one of the things that actually deeply causes a system to change is to stop futzing with it. Right? You actually sort of take your attempt at manipulating it to being better out of the picture. Take your hands off the controls in a certain way.
Yeah.
And it turned out that you might not have been making it better. You might have actually just been making it kind of worse by grabbing at it, trying to be a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
You let that go.
Mm-hmm.
You get a little more peaceful, but also your disturbance of the system stops,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
So, and you know, this is sort of, there's a lot of hay made nowadays about how this kind of crosses into quantum mechanics, right? The idea that like the observer or the one doing the measurement affects the thing that they're observing or measuring.
Mm-hmm.
They can't not. Right, you can't measure something without touching it in a certain way, which changes its position or velocity, one of the two. And so like, oh, you're taking your hands off the wheel isn't just a letting things be as they are, it actually affects them.
Yeah.
And it can sometimes affect them in the direction of increased well-being.
Mm-hmm.
So then you get this wonderful paradox that one of the best ways to engage is to disengage. Right? In this kind of curious way. Or a good first step toward engaging wisely is to disengage wisely.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So before I know how to fix something, I might stop screwing with it for a second and observe, right? Step back and see if I can see what's happening. And then be like, oh, this is what's happening, and this is what I was doing to perpetuate what was happening. You know. We could take something like, you know, we take something like, say, something racism, let's say, for a huge and seemingly unfixable social ill that I want to engage in relation to, right? Like, this should be different, and what could I do? Like, that's a natural impulse when I see the suffering of it. But then, if I really look at it, one of the first things I see, of course, is that the actions that perpetuate it are embedded in myself, right? I'm not separate from the system. So I'm like, I see my own bias, my own complicity or oppression within the system. I'm embedded in the system in all these ways. And so then the first, before I even get to sort of step back and observe it with some sort of, you know, witness distance, I have to even figure out how to step back from it, which means I have to change my own action first. I have to be like, I have to see my own bias and then restrain the actions that spill out from that. Right? I try to restrain my speech, restrain my actions. Notice that thing that is painful is embedded in myself. I can't accept it without actually seeing my own role in it clearly. That's part of what that stepping back would entail. So I do some of that work, and it gives me the tiniest bit of distance. And distance just means the distance where my eyes can focus, basically. Like, if I'm too embedded in it, I can't see it clearly. I learn how to know who I am in relation to it just a tiny bit, and then I can see it. Like, and usually the first thing I see is I'm like, holy shit, this is terrible. This is worse than I thought. Because I was so in it, I couldn't see it. All I could really see was like my own patterns. So then there's always this dance between the two. If I want to fix things, I actually have to know myself more deeply so that I can even know what to do or be effective and not just reproduce the pattern again and again. I'm trying to fix it, but I'm just doing my habitual thing. Turns out that the problem is embedded in my habitual thing. I'm not actually part of the solution yet. So I have to actually figure out what my role is. And to do that, I go to the renunciate side of the spectrum. I figure out how to step back for a moment and know who I am. And then, so I kind of oscillate between the two. Yeah, it's kind of the same way that you're saying. You know.
So where is your base? Are you on the razor sharp?
Me personally?
In the process of observing the engagement and the renunciation. Isn't that what he said?
It feels like that sometimes. Right, you can dance it, you can be falling it.
You gotta have some trust.
You need a lot of trust. You need it's practice, right? The heart of practice in a certain way is a kind of discernment where you're actually trying to see clearly both where you are and what to do. Mm. Right? What's happening? What do I do? What's happening? What can I do? That's it. Mm. That's all you get.
So we're floating.
You're floating in a certain way. These two things represent kind of just like, it's not like one is disengaged, the other is engaged. They're actually just both ways to engage, right? There's no actual disengagement, right? Where are you going to go? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know Elon Musk is trying to get to Mars very quickly, but it's not going to be a place free of greed, hatred, and delusion. Mm-hmm. Especially if Elon Musk is the one to take us there. But, you know, whoever it was, that would be the case. There's nowhere to go. So then you kind of float, and you're like, what's the right action for this situation? And that's the question that you keep landing back at over and over. What's the right action for this situation? And so then there's two points, right? There's the action and the situation. Like, what's happening now requires the renunciate or like the pure awareness aspect to recognize what's happening. Mm-hmm. And then what do I do means some kind of engagement. Whether that engagement is like, I need to do less in this moment, or it's time to lean in and do more. And that's just a choice that we want to make as clearly as we can. So, you know, in a certain way, this is a deep Buddhist talk that just, after all that, lands us back at the old serenity prayer, right? Mm-hmm. Right? Change the things you can, accept the things you can't, figure out which is which. Yeah? And to put it in Buddhist terms, figuring out how to do that, practicing doing that, is the path. But what it leads to is an experience that doesn't consist of fully either end of things, but an experience of being free in relation to them. Right? They're both actually just processes to engage in the as a kind of purification or liberation process. The result isn't a particular kind of action as much as a kind of understanding and way of being in the middle of it. And then once you're a Buddha, you just carry on doing the exact same thing, right? What's happening now? How do I respond? That never stops as long as there's consciousness. So, all right, that's a good place to pause for the night. Carry on being aware and acting, doing things. I mean, try to stop, you know, but not really, you know. We'll continue with this text a bit, exploring, see what, you know, how it unfolds over the next few weeks. Welcome to new folks, good to have you, and to folks beginning to come more, lovely to have you. And I think we'll have another Sangha picnic at some point this spring. So I'll look for a date for that. And we'll see if we can do. We've done a few in the past. Pick a weekend afternoon to have snacks in a park. Toddlers and dogs running around. Beings from all six realms running around, as they do in the parks around here. So thanks for your presence and your practice. Thank you for your generosity, offering your resources in service of the class continuing as an open space for everyone to come as accessibly as we can make it. Gifts of money or anything else that fit in the little box can go in the little box or be given at the front desk. I get part of that. The studio gets part of that. And all the talks are online on my website. You can go back and listen to others. And I'll see you soon. Take good care.
Thanks, Albert.
Yeah, thanks you all.